This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hi, radio listeners. This is your host, Howie Baum, doing my weekly reading of interesting articles from the December and January issue of Wired Magazine. I'm going to continue with the article and I hope get done with it. I know it's been extra long. How to Create a Monster, Amazon, Spotify, Netflix, PayPal, Slack, all blown off the internet for millions of people. Three young hackers built a web-killing superweapon called Mirai. Then they lost control of it. This is their untold story. I'm going to read the paragraph right before where I stopped. Over the 6 months since the raid of his home, Paris had remained in denial, putting on a defiant face, but quietly living in a state of latent terror. His family had never again discussed the traumatic violation of their home by federal agents, instead pretending it had never happened. They were going through the motions of being a family, as Paris put it, but there's this cloud hanging over everyone's head. The cloud of silence remained in place as Paris and his father flew to Anchorage, Alaska. Along with Paris' lawyer, they met with Peterson and Alexander in the same Department of Justice conference room and got the same cheery hiking tips from Peterson. Paris tried to maintain an implacable expression as the prosecutor threw one damning piece of evidence after another onto the screen, laying out his crimes in front of his father. They showed Paris' connections to the Mirai handles and to Anna Senpai and his FireSwap burner account. Still, Paris told himself that the case was far from clear-cut. Then Alexander played for the room a series of audio recordings of the three hackers explicitly discussing their new click fraud venture. One conversation from a night when Paris and Dalton had been drinking and let down their guard was particularly incriminating. For Paris, it was the first confirmation of Hosiah's betrayal. Just as with Hosiah, the meeting paused for a break after an hour. Paris, his father, and his lawyer walked across the street from the prosecutor's office into a small park of paper birch trees in front of the Anchorage Museum. It was dismally cold, cloudy day, though Paris says his anxiety had reached a degree where he was disassociating, barely aware of his surroundings. Paris' lawyer leveled with him. It sounded very much like he was guilty of the crimes that he had until then denied, even to his own attorney. Standing there in the park, Paris finally broke. Huddling with his father and lawyer, he confessed, tears flowing as he unlocked the shame, guilt, and fear that he'd kept bottled for months. He asked his father to cut ties with him, begged him to let him face whatever punishment he had brought on himself alone. His father responded in a voice as broken as Paris' own, he never could do that. Instead, he and the lawyer both told Paris that there was no other way out now. His only chance to save himself was to do whatever the FBI and the prosecutors asked him. Unbeknownst to them, Peterson and Alexander had watched the three men speaking from the window across the street. From Paris' body language, they could tell they'd made a breakthrough. When Paris came back inside, he was a different person, his defenses down. "You're in a hole, Paris," Peterson told him. "It's time to stop digging." He was ready to cooperate. Alexander asked him whether he had told anyone that he was coming to Alaska, and he admitted that he had told Dalton. So Alexander and Peterson asked Paris to call Dalton now, on the spot, on speakerphone, and tell him that he had nothing to worry about. Paris did as he was told. Dalton picked up the call, and as the FBI and prosecutor sat around the table, intently listening, Paris assured Dalton that it was just as they thought. The feds had nothing on them. When it was Dalton's turn to be raided, Peterson practically scheduled it with him. A few weeks before the bang on the door, Yahoo had mistakenly sent Dalton a letter stating that his old email address had been the subject of a legal request. For more information, it read, he should contact FBI Special Agent Elliot Peterson. So Dalton preemptively called the FBI agent who now had been stalking them for nearly a year. Hosiah and Paris, playing their roles as supportive friends, listened in. Peterson picked up the phone and said hello and immediately apologized. I wasn't planning on us talking for a couple of weeks, he explained. When Dalton claimed not to know who Peterson was or why his emails were being read, the FBI agent laughed out loud. We're going to have a great opportunity to have a chat, he said, in the most aggressive version of his usual genial tone. He ended the call by confirming with Dalton that he was still living at home, despite having now started college, implying he didn't want to search Dalton's parents' house if he had moved into a dormitory. We tried to be minimally invasive. Dalton hung up with Peterson. What the F was that? He said to Hosiah and Paris, who were still on the group call. Your ass, Paris responded. For the next 3 weeks, Dalton was stricken with nausea, inducing anxiety and a sense of impending doom. When the feds finally arrived before dawn, he says he was actually relieved. They found him in his boxer shorts, wrapped in a pink blanket on a beanbag, watching Star Wars. During the search, Dalton says his anxiety evaporated thanks to his early swatting experience. It wasn't his first time having law enforcement point a gun at him, and he did his best to show the feds that he wasn't impressed. He napped on a couch during the FBI search. When Peterson tried to interview him, he gave him nothing. In fact, with plenty of time to prepare before they arrived, Dalton had physically destroyed all his most sensitive hard drives. The agents found his beloved water-cooled PC torn apart. Its red coolant spilled across the bedroom floor like blood. He'd carefully cached another drive that stored all the bitcoins earned from their click fraud scheme inside a cat food container, fully hidden by kibble. Since the container was transparent, the searching agents didn't think to look inside. Just as with Paris and Hosiah, Peterson told Dalton not to tell anyone about the search. But Dalton, loyal to the end, tried to send a coded message to Paris that he had been raided too. He repeatedly toggled the status of his account on the Steam video game network on and off in Morse code, spelling FBI. Paris saw Dalton's account blinking, but he never got the message. Of course, even if he had, he already had been working with the FBI for months to collect evidence on his friend. Dalton soon took his own trip to Anchorage, where he and his parents sat through Peterson and Alexander's third and final Mirai reverse proper presentation. Through an hour of damning chat logs and audio recordings, Dalton showed no emotion. But when it was over, he knew there was no use resisting. They had everything. When Dalton reluctantly agreed to cooperate, Peterson didn't ask him to keep their arrangement secret from Hosiah and Paris. This time, he phoned the other two. All four of them joined the call. After months of paranoia, Peterson wanted to clear the air, to tell them that they were no longer cooperating against one another. They would now all be working together. Hosiah remembers it almost like a reunion, meeting each other again now that they were all on the other side. In the call, Hosiah and Paris seemed relieved to finally be able to speak honestly to each other and Dalton after months of subterfuge. Dalton agreed in a defeated tone that yes, he was on board. They would give up all their hacking tools and dismantle the click fraud botnet, and Dalton would forfeit the hidden hard drive full of their bitcoins. But Peterson remembers that Dalton remained quiet and formal, seemingly still processing his anger and shame at having been cornered by the FBI and surveilled by his friends. It was only late one night, a few days after Dalton got home to New Orleans, that he allowed the full reality of his situation to catch up with him. He was facing a felony conviction. He was going to have to work as a federal informant, and he was still likely to end up in prison. It felt hopeless. The person he chose to call to talk this over with, strangely, wasn't Hosiah or Paris, but Peterson. He was trapped, he told the FBI agent in tears. His life was over. For the next hour, Peterson, sitting in his living room in Anchorage, found himself back in his Dean of Men role, comforting and counseling the young cyber criminal who'd so recently been the target of his investigation. Peterson asked Dalton about his hopes for the future, the "where do you see yourself in 5 years" question of every guidance counselor. Dalton confessed that beneath his old secret belief that cybercrime could be his only path in life, he still hoped that someday he might be able to have a normal, successful job in technology. Peterson told him that was still possible. "He was super nice," Dalton says, "far nicer than he ever needed to be." Peterson said he couldn't promise Dalton that it would all be okay. There was still the possibility of spending years in prison. Regardless, Peterson assured Dalton he could still go to college. He could still do something rewarding with his talents. His life was not over. The young men's lawyers had each warned them that to have any hope of avoiding prison, they would need to go above and beyond in their cooperation with the FBI and prosecutors. So once they found themselves on the same team again, Hosiah, Dalton, and Paris threw themselves into working with law enforcement with the same obsessive energy that they had once put into conquering the Internet of Things. All three were still deeply embedded in the cyber criminal community. In fact, Mirai had turned the personae that Paris had created into celebrities. So to start, they began helping the FBI target their old associates. It was Paris, the Mirai creator, who had opened Pandora's box by publishing the botnet's source code, who found himself most actively working undercover to take down Mirai's copycats. Because he still controlled the Anna Senpai handle, Paris was tasked with reaching out to the creator of one especially prolific Mirai knockoff. The copycat botnet was controlled by a hacker who lived near Portland, Oregon. He'd been brash enough to reveal his location to Anna Senpai in their chats, and even to invite Mirai's creator to hang out if he were ever in town. Paris took him up on the offer. At that point, Peterson and Alexander had been tracking the suspect and believed they knew his identity, but he appeared to have no fixed address. He seemed to have developed a serious drug problem and had admitted to using meth in his chats with Anna Senpai, and instead roamed around the city from house to house with little more than a backpack and the laptop he used to manage his botnet. After Paris flew to Portland, he suggested to the target of their sting that they meet at his hotel. Sure enough, the hacker turned up, and the two botnet admins spent a few hours in Paris' room there, swapping stories and hacking tricks, and even inviting other hacker associates to join the conversation via Skype. Meanwhile, Peterson and other FBI agents recorded the meeting, with eavesdropping techniques they declined to describe from another room across the hallway. Eventually, the young Portland hacker suggested they head to a nearby Little Caesars to eat. When he and Paris walked out of the room, he carelessly left his laptop open and didn't even bother to close the video chat session with his hacker friends. Those friends who were still watching through the laptop's webcam when Peterson and another agent came into the room and seized the computer's evidence. Less than an hour later, the agents stepped out of a black van in the hotel parking lot and arrested their target as he and Paris returned from their lunch. After that Portland sting, some of the hackers who had just watched the accidental live stream of the hotel raid accused Paris of acting as the FBI snitch. Paris pointed out that it hadn't been his idea to meet up or even to conveniently go out for pizza, arguing that maybe he was, in fact, the one who had been set up. The explanation was convincing enough that Paris managed to pull off subsequent undercover operations against multiple other cybercriminal suspects across the country. He says he hardly relished his role in those stings, but nor did he feel much guilt. I mean, honestly, it was exhilarating, he says. It felt like something out of a movie. The FBI and the Justice Department declined to share all of the details of the investigations that Paris and the other two Mirai creators helped them pursue. But Peterson summarizes them. We arrested people, and we worked other cases against IoT botnets, and we shut down other botnets where arrest wasn't feasible, he says. We just really did interesting work. After a few months, when they had run out of undercover cases, Peterson began to give the team different kinds of tasks, many of them with no direct relationship to Mirai or their old contacts. They were grateful to find they were no longer acting as informants, so much as Peterson's new group of technical analysts. They started helping the FBI agent with jobs like reverse engineering malware and analyzing logs to identify botnet victims. They built a software tool that parsed the blockchain to trace cybercriminal cryptocurrency. In early 2018, when hackers began to exploit server software known as Memcached to amplify their DDoS attacks, the Mirai team figured out how to scan for vulnerable servers that enabled those attacks so that the FBI could warn the server's owners and help remove a new kind of DDoS ammunition from the internet. Hosea says that in his new role, he couldn't help but apply the same technical perfectionism he had always prided himself on. I enjoy being the best of this sort of stuff, he says. I thought if we're going to work on this, it darn well better work right. Paris says that at first, he had immersed himself in Peterson's assignments, even the harrowing undercover ones, mostly on his lawyer's advice and as a distraction from his lingering guilt and shame. To prevent myself from feeling things, as Paris put it, but over time he found that he was able to look at the work more squarely and to even some gratification from the good he felt he was now doing. Peterson's comments to him in Alaska that he should stop digging the hole he was in had stuck. The work for Peterson felt like the opposite of digging, as he puts it. I wanted to put as much distance as possible between who I am now and who I was then, he says. Eventually, when the Mirai crew talked among themselves about their motivation to work with Peterson, Paris says it went beyond self-interested survival to a sense of actual atonement for the harm that they had done. It was like, okay, what is our path to redemption? He says, maybe this is the start. The FBI, of course, has a long unsavory record of exploiting informants and cooperating defendants, many of whom are put in dangerous situations, made to entrap innocent associates, or end up feeling abandoned or used by their handlers. The three Mirai hackers felt they were an exception. As the months passed, they say, they came to see Peterson as a kind of mentor. He seemed to show real concern for their futures. The strange friendliness he displayed while hunting them, they felt, was not an aggressive front, but an actual expression of his humanity. "We were very lucky that we got Elliot," says Dalton. "He literally saved my life." The U.S. criminal justice system has a history of notoriously harsh sentences for hackers. In 2010, Albert Gonzalez was sentenced to 20 years in prison for stealing tens of millions of debit and credit card numbers from retailer networks when he was in his mid-20s. In 2017, Russian cyber criminal Roman Selesnev, arrested on vacation at the Maldives airport, was sentenced to 27 years for his own massive threat of credit card data. Even Hector Montsegur, a frontman for the rampaging hacktivist group LoseSec, who flipped on his friends and served as a federal informant for more than 2 years, was jailed for 7 months, longer than some other members of LoseSec in the United Kingdom he had informed on. So it was an almost a radical act when the prosecutors in the case of Mirai, the botnet behind several of the biggest cyber attacks in history, asked the judge to sentence its creators to a total of 0 days in prison. Adam Alexander, the Alaskan assistant U.S. attorney who had flipped each of the three hackers with PowerPoint presentations full of evidence against them, explains that his decision was based in part on the fact that none of them had prior criminal history or substance abuse problems that might have led them to fall back into old habits. Unlike many defendants, they had strong family support networks holding them accountable. Most importantly, by the time their sentencing was approaching in the fall of 2018, they had done more than 1,000 hours of work for Peterson, what Alexander described in a letter to the judge as extensive and exceptional cooperation. "They were kind of gleefully willing to break the internet," Alexander says, "but would putting any of the three of these young people in prison for 18 to 36 months and then wiping our hands of them have been more meaningful, assured that we could prevent future criminal conduct? I didn't actually think so then, and still don't think so today." Instead, he asked the court to sentence Hosiah, Dalton, and Paris to 2,500 hours of community service each over the following 5 years. They would carry out that work with the same FBI agent who had supervised their presentence cooperation period, Elliot Peterson. In an Anchorage courtroom roughly 2 years after Mirai had obliterated Brian Krebs' website, a judge handed down that sentence, community service, no prison time, to the three 21 and 22-year-olds, along with debts of between $115,000 and $127,000 each in restitution. "You're young, you have a lot to give to society, and you have a lot of talent and skill," a judge told the three men in his Anchorage courtroom that fall day. "I hope you use it for good." Paris would face separate charges in New Jersey for his attacks on Rutgers, where prosecutors vehemently argued that he deserved prison time. Alexander intervened, countering that Paris' cooperation with prosecutors and the FBI in Alaska should be factored into his sentencing in that case, too. The New Jersey judge ultimately agreed, sentencing Paris to nearly $9 million on more in restitution and 6 months of confinement at his parents' home, but no jail time. On this visit to Alaska, when Peterson again suggested local activities, the Mirai crew actually took him up on it. That evening, they ate together at a local indie theater restaurant, the Beartooth Grill, where they also caught a screening of a documentary about Google's Go-playing AI, just some notorious hackers and the FBI agent who hunted them down, out for dinner and a movie. Not long into their 5-year community service stint, Peterson says he began to sense that his 3 unlikely proteges were beginning to outgrow him, that he couldn't find enough technical tasks worthy of their talents. So he asked the Big Pipes anti-DDoS group he'd helped create with Allison Nixon if anyone there had work for them to do. Nixon raised her hand. When Peterson at first started overseeing the kids, as they came to be known within Big Pipes, Nixon had wanted nothing to do with them. She'd spent long enough lurking in the hack forum cesspool to be familiar with the toxicity that flowed freely there, and had even been personally harassed by some of the Mirai's team's old associates. "They're not nice people," she says of that scene. "You don't want them to know your name." But after seeing that Peterson had worked with Paris, Hosiah, and Dalton for more than a year and was still willing to vouch for them, she decided to take a chance and met them on a video call. She found the 3 young hackers, including the notorious Hosiah Lightspeed White, whom she tracked for nearly his entire career, polite and eager to please. She did, in fact, need their programming help. She had an idea for a new kind of honeypot that would be far more versatile than her sad DVR. She wanted to create a system where security researchers or analysts could load up any Internet of Things device firmware in a virtual environment to catch new malware variants. The tool they built together was called Watchtower. It used a newer technology called QEMU containerization to spin up quarantined, full-fledged simulations of DVRs waiting to be infected. The Mirai team had designed their Internet of Things malware to detect when it loaded on a software simulation of a gadget rather than the real thing, and to kill its processes rather than give a researcher any information. But Watchtower's honeypot was designed to look like a real device in every way that malware could check. A seamless virtual panopticon which to observe malware and intercept its master's commands. Well, folks, that wraps up this reading of this article in the December and January issue of Wired Magazine. I will finish the short ending next week and go on to the March and April issue of Wired. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. I will continue reading from it next week. This is your host, Howie Baum, wishing you a great day.